Here for 583.
Yes.
If you want to come up, I'll have staff get us started with what we're doing here at this point.
Thank you. Senate Bill 583 is a bill that enacts the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Act Protection Act. It requires notification to consumers for breach of security of computerized data, allows consumers to freeze or block access to their credit for a $10 fee, or for free if they're a victim of identity theft. It allows consumers to temporarily lift the freeze for $10, prohibits printing or displaying of Social Security numbers unless made unreadable with some exceptions. It creates a duty to safeguard personal information. It authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to enforce and make rules to regulate provisions of the bill, including assessing penalties of not more than $1,000 for every violation and $500,000 for any occurrence. It declares an emergency on all provisions except the duty to safeguard with an effective date of October 1. The duty to safeguard provisions are effective January
1, 2008. Thank you. Senator, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Floyd Krasomsky, State Senator, Senator District 4. Thank you very much for having us this morning. We're here on Senate Bill 583A. I am here to, I guess, kind of give you a preview as to why we're here and what the bill does based on the staff summary measure that you've heard as to what the points are. I do want to go ahead and, I guess, start off, though, and I was going to be a little bit more tacky than maybe I should be, but at the same time, let me just start off with kind of a perspective. We've got three different areas we're going to cover. First of all, I guess I question where I should start. Should I start with the district phone call that I received in my office at 5:05 on Friday regarding new amendments that were going to be proposed to this committee? Should I talk about the committee, the amendment that we made in our committee right before the work session, and when one group came before us and said that they wanted to get engaged into the work session at that time? Or do I start with the creation of this bill? And I think I'll start there. Mr. Chair, what happened is we had a group that met for about 7 months prior to the session starting. We started last summer and worked on a monthly basis with a group of that focused somewhere between 20 and 30 individuals who were representing individual groups or agencies for the public entities that were involved. Through that creation and that work and long hours and a lot of commitment from all those individuals that were participants, we came up with what is now Senate Bill 583A. After the session began, we continued to meet and met for another 2 to 3 months through this process, making sure that we were covering all the needs that were put on the table through this process, doing the checks and such. So what you have before you today is a bill that was, in fact, passed out of committee on 583A. Which basically does, in fact, establish the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act. I have Corey Stasslinger here with me. We'll go through the bill as to what the particulars are. Specifically, the reason the bill is before you today is because DCBS's budget was already handled prior to this bill coming through the process. Unfortunately, my office, the governor's office, and I think DCBS didn't realize that this was not put into the budget as to being considered how the funding was going to be done. Corey will go over the agreement that was made by the work group as to how the funding was going to be set up. I understand that you may have an amendment being offered to you to change the funding source from Mr. Martinez. I also understand that you are potentially going to get some amendments from Mr. Dewey, who represents LexisNexis. I think it'd be probably, before I go into that area, why don't we just kind of give you a snapshot of what the bill will do, and then I'll come back and give you the position that I, as chair, have taken on these amendments. Mr. Chair, if that's all right with you.
Fine. Thank you, Richard. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'll just briefly go over what's in this bill. Sorry. As Senator Pozanski said, it was the product of a fairly extensive interim work group with broad participation from industry, law enforcement, consumer groups, governmental representatives, and, of course, members of this body. And the bill contains four major sections. First of all, and we, I believe, have handed out to you a summary and a section-by-section analysis, the bill requires businesses and organizations that collect personal identification, identifiable information from an individual to have reasonable safeguards in place to protect that confidentiality of that information. It sets out some guidelines as to what would meet the standards of the bill. It also is intended to be quite flexible in the range of options available to businesses in safeguarding information, and particularly recognizes that small businesses can adopt measures that are appropriate for their size and activities and the type of information that they have. The bill also contains provisions protecting Social Security numbers, prohibiting the public display of more than the last four digits of a Social Security number, with an exception for records that are, by law, made available to the public in certain aspects. Thirdly, there is a requirement that in the event of a data breach, that is a theft of computerized data, a computer hacking incident, consumers are required to be notified if their personally identifiable information has been placed at risk. In most cases, this will be written notice. If certain thresholds are met, then published notice is also acceptable. That's if the cost of notification individually would be very high or the number of people involved is very large. And then finally, any Oregonian, whether or not they have been a victim of identity theft, would have a right to place a freeze on the accounts maintained at the major credit reporting agencies. And with a freeze in place, those credit reporting agencies would not be allowed to disclose credit information to someone seeking that information, thereby making it difficult, if not impossible, for an identity thief to open new credit accounts or obtain credit in the name of that person. That right would be available to someone whether or not they have been a victim of identity theft, but if they have not been a victim, then they would be expected to pay a reasonable fee for the privilege of that freeze, and also a fee to unfreeze temporarily or permanently if they choose to obtain additional credit. Now, there's one comment I wanted to make on the record at the request, actually, of the banking industry. You'll see in the bill that where existing federal standards already deal with these areas, we have relied on the federal standards as being sufficient and have not attempted to put a new or separate state standard in place. And some of those standards are under the federal Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. Some of them are other federal statutes. So we recognize that some of the entities subject to this bill may have other regulators, such as the Federal Trade Commission, federal banking regulators, the Department of Health and Human Services, that's primarily for HIPAA, the Health Information Bill, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. These federal regulators are charged with enforcing federal laws such as Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, and some of these laws do touch on subjects that are included in this bill. Further, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency exercises certain examination and enforcement authority over national banks in some areas to the exclusion of other governmental entities, both state and federal. So what we wanted to make clear on the record is to the extent that federal laws regarding examination of national banks preempt state laws and regulations, we recognize that national banks would be exempted from such examination and enforcement at the state level. So a statement of preemption, which, as I said, I was asked to put on the record, and we're happy to do that. With respect to the funding issues reflected in this bill, as Senator Pozanski said, the work group fairly late in the process addressed the issue of enforcement. There were a number of possibilities discussed in the work group as to how enforcement should take place. In many states, enforcement is through Unfair Trade Practices Act, Department of Justice, private right of action. For a number of reasons, the preference of the work group was not to go that route, but instead to ask DCBS to take on the administration and enforcement requirements. Because that happened fairly late in the discussions, it was too late to be incorporated into the governor's budget, which is why you did not see this when the DCBS budget was before Ways and Means Committee, but it does have our support and the governor's support. We are not requesting any appropriation. We are requesting two additional FTE and appropriate additional limitation. The funds will come from existing revenue sources, fees paid by industries that do pay fees to DCBS. And in the LFO analysis, you will see how we intend to allocate those this biennium as well as future biennia. This biennium, it's intended to be pro rata across the various financial sectors that we regulate. Next biennium and in the future, it's our intent to put forward a budget that uses a more broad-based funding source, and in particular what we are thinking about at the moment is our source of fees that are collected from the securities industry, which are by statute set at the national median specifically on purpose to generate excess revenue, which then goes to the general fund beyond program needs. So you'll see that in the legislative fiscal analysis. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Director Schlesinger, wouldn't it be more appropriate for this effort to be funded by the general fund, since it's going to be benefiting all Oregonians, rather than to be funded eventually by the industry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, of course that's a policy call for this committee to make. By using the securities revenue stream, in effect, it is a general fund funding source because it uses funds that would otherwise flow to the general fund. So other side of the ledger, but general fund impact in the same way. And in our consultations with Legislative Fiscal Office, they felt that for budgetary and structural purposes, that was a cleaner way to do it.
That's interesting. Another question, please.
Regarding
the, I thank you for the clarification, the National Bank exemption. But isn't their exemption from state regulation pretty much complete? In that, I believe under Section 84 provides for exemption to the OCC's exclusive visitorial authority for state examiners inspecting for compliance with state unclaimed property or as cheat laws, with reasonable cause to believe the bank has failed to comply with those laws. Those are about the only two things that that the states really have a oversight authority on the national banks, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it actually, there are a great many state regulatory laws that apply to national banks. Within my own department, for example, workers' compensation laws. A national bank is required to provide workers' compensation coverage. Oregon OSHA, a national bank is required to comply with workplace safety standards that are imposed by Oregon. Building codes. A national bank is required to comply with building codes in expanding a new branch. Elsewhere in state government, employment laws. Wage and hour laws. So there are a wide variety of state laws of general applicability that apply to state banks. But those are all subjects of discussion, and certainly our belief is to the extent that federal law preempts, it's preempted. We don't actually need to resolve that issue in this bill because federal law always takes precedent over anything we say in state law.
Okay. Follow up, please.
So
there are some visitorial powers of the state over regulatory banking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, they are not visitorial powers used in a technical sense in the federal law. My understanding is that those things which are within the technical definition of visitorial powers, no, the state does not exercise those powers. But if you were to ask me, in general terms, are there enforcement powers? Yes, there are, outside of the federal banking laws.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up regarding the amendments. You've already heard from Corey as to what we believe will be a discussion that you will be having regarding the funding. I guess that is something that you will need to make a decision at this point as to on a policy basis. There was an agreement within the group that there would be one-time funding as proposed currently under the bill. From what you've heard from the director, at this point they've already started their plans as to how they can shift from that funding source into the other source, which actually would be money streaming into the general fund, but instead of having it go into the general fund and then coming back out, it would be earmarked for this purpose in the future, if that's something that you want to look at either now or at the next time the bill would be coming before you for funding, which would be next session. I do want to talk to you because I'm not sure at what stage or to what level Mr. Dewey is going to be bringing forward any amendments. What I have that was dropped off of my office on Friday by the Department of Consumer and Business Services is apparently a proposal for three sets of amendments. I will tell you that I did, in fact, meet with Mr. Dewey and his client prior to the work session. After having a discussion with him and their concern about some of the language in the bill, I took it upon myself to get what was known as the Dash 4 amendments drafted that actually came right out of the codes from Arkansas, which is one of the ones that he wanted me to consider. We adopted that based on his request. After that meeting, after the work session, I checked in with him, asked him if that was all right, how did he feel, and he told me at that point he wasn't comfortable and he was coming back after the bill again. My problem is process here, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we've had an opportunity where we've had a number of people that and stakeholders involved for over a seven-month period prior to the session beginning, and then afterwards, in an attempt to try to even accommodate, I can see that some of the proposed amendments that Mr. Dewey may be bringing forward are the ones that we had already considered in the policy committee, and I'm asking this committee not to take those up at this time, allow the bill to go forward as is, and that if there are issues that need to be addressed in the future, we can tweak it when the time is appropriate through the next process. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Any questions for Senator Brzezinski? Representative, please.
I guess my question is somewhat to you and then also to the Senator, just on the last argument in terms of the process. And I know that this has been going on for a long time and a lot of hard work has been done. But and just in terms of the purview of this committee, ostensibly we're supposed to be looking at funding and understand to some degree the argument about, well, sort of the policy changes shouldn't happen here. So are you saying that we shouldn't entertain policy changes even if we perceive that they were going to make a better bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, no, I'm not saying that. We believe, based on the work that's been done by this committee, excuse me, and the work group for over a seven-month period plus another 2 months that we've pretty well ironed out everything that needs to be addressed at this point. Clearly, if this committee felt that a policy change needed to be made to make it a better bill or if there's a problem, so be it. One of the things I do know that has happened in the Ways and Means process when policy amendments are considered, usually the committee will look to the chair of the substantive committee for guidance and also for those who are directly involved in that process. I'm just giving you, let's say, the preview of where I'm at before you get to hear whatever you may hear from any of the other advocates that have come in after the fact, after and not being part of this process.
Follow up.
Well, I was going to ask, can I ask a question about one of the substantive amendments?
Of course.
Well, so the amendment that refers to page 4, lines 12 and 13, just trying to shift or change the language so that instead of reasonable likelihood of harm, it would be reasonable likelihood of identity theft or fraud. I'm just wondering what's your take on why that standard change of the standard would be problematic.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, it's interesting that you chose that one because that's the one we actually fixed for Mr. Dewey and his client, and using the language that he gave to us from Arkansas that basically said notification under this section is not required if, after reasonable investigation, the person or business determines that there is no reasonable likelihood of harm to customers. And what Mr. Dewey apparently is wanting to do now is find a different standard for harm, one that actually narrows the scope as to the part of ID and fraud. I believe that the consumers deserve to have the analysis done on the level of reasonable likelihood of harm, no matter what that harm could be to that customer, and not narrowly interpret it by someone that's making that decision as to whether they think it pertains to ID theft or fraud alone. I think there could be other harm that could occur that could, in fact, and should, in fact, require notification to be given.
Follow-up.
Such as? I'm just concerned, you know, what other type of harm could occur?
Some, in a sense of misuse of that information that may not be equivalent to identity theft or fraud, something that's not, let's say, criminal in nature, but still, in fact, could cause an issue, civil.
Or even pure financial theft.
Financial, yeah.
Theft.
Not identity theft, just
correct.
Theft.
Correct.
Is that what you...
Yes, that would be a possibility, for example. Not pretending to be you, but simply stealing your money.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Senator, questions?
For Senator Brzezinski, please. Harm is not defined in this bill.
It is not.
Yeah, okay.
It's not. We basically took the statute that Mr. Dewey gave to us and we put it in there, and I guess, again, I'm coming back to process. He asked for it. He got it. Now he wants something different.
Just comment, perhaps...
Senator Whitson, follow up.
In my mind, perhaps the best bill is what we should be trying to do, as opposed to being too concerned about process. And I understand your concern there, but I mean, at the end of the day, I would think that we would try to do what is best for the. And do you think that Senator Brzezinski, that a more narrow definition of harm would be appropriate for this bill, or do you think a broad open-ended definition of harm is better?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett, first of all, I guess harm is not defined in the bill. It would have the definition that comes out of Webster's and interpretation. I do believe a broader is better, because when you get into the narrow, you're, as we've already put on the record, that you're limiting as to when that notification is required, and you're going to have someone at this point, based on the amendment that may be coming forward, it would be based on two types of harm, identity theft or fraud, and that's it. And I believe a broader definition of harm, one that does not have to be limited exclusively to identity theft or fraud, is better for the consumer.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator, I think you've been talking so far about the proposals, the amendments that Mr. Dewey brought forth. But I have a dash 9 and a dash 14 here, which I don't know that they're his amendments as such. Are you aware of them, and do you have a position or comment on them?
Mr. Chair, I'm not. All I know is what was delivered to my office late on Friday. They were not actually in amendment form.
I guess apologies, since these seem to have, table this morning. I would say something in relationship to the process, and I see Corey maybe has some comments on these, but in relationship to process, there certainly would be no intention of this committee, I don't believe, to not take the sponsor of the legislation and the chair of the committee that the legislation came through into consideration as we are dealing with these. I think that It's a little presumptuous that we would, in a few minutes, be able to gain wisdom that took months of labor on the part of folks to get here. However, having said that, if there is a firm belief on the part of the committee that there is a better bill with some addition to it, then I think we would be obligated to the people of the state to to make that amendment, but not without discussion and conversation with the chair of the committee before we entered into that round. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. One important piece of information for me would be that at the end of this lengthy work group that I know started with a lot of divergent points of view, was it the consensus of the work group that Senate Bill 583 reflected the work product of the work group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that's exactly right, and that's one of the things I'm advocating for, is not only as the chair of this committee, but also the chair or one of the co-chairs for the work group and the product. We agreed as a work group that this is what we wanted and felt was a great starting point to initially put into the books a statute that would deal with protection of consumers from identity theft. Realizing that there could always be tweaks made. In fact, there has been some suggestions based on some recent news reports to actually broaden the bill to include a little greater protections and putting forth those particular situations directly into the bill. But it was my decision based on the chair, as the chair, and based on what the work group had decided, that we would go with this as our product, and that after a year or a session or two, if necessary, come back in and make modifications at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
If I could, I believe the Dash A9 amendments are the technical amendments from legislative fiscal to make the necessary adjustment to the department's budget.
Okay. Are you aware of the 14th?
I am not.
Okay.
No, we don't have them.
Huh? Well, I seem to be blessed with that.
Yeah. You are the only one so blessed, Mr. Chair.
That may well be, and we're trying to run down a little more information on them, but we won't do anything with them until we have had discussion about them.
Mr. Chair, my amendments, I think, ended somewhere around Dash 5 or Dash 6, so you're way far ahead of us.
Yeah. Well, I've got an 11, 12, and 13 here. So,
Mr. Chair, it might be useful to know the genesis of 11, 12, and 13.
We will.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Senator. Appreciate your testimony. Corey, we appreciate and I assume Lou was taken care of. You're just here for professional advice. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry I didn't ask this earlier. So the LFO amendment is supported by the work group and the chair of the committee and the sponsor of the bill, correct?
That's my understanding.
Okay. Yes. I just want to make sure I understand.
I have a few folks here signed up. We will have a little bit of a time crunch, but Jim Craven, Jim Markey, and Dave Fiskum. Let's just take two. Mr. Fiskum on the next round.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association representing the high-tech industry, and we have worked on similar legislation to this around the country, so that's part of the perspective we bring. I was a member of the work group. I think it really started about a year ago. I think it was last June, and so here we are, a year later. I just want, we support the bill, Senate Bill 583. We think it's one of the better bills covering these topics that's been done around the country, partly just because the time we put into it, and partly because other bodies around the country have wrestled with this the last couple of years, and we benefited from being slightly behind. There are some benefits not to be first, which is to pick up some of the debates and wrangling over language that have occurred in other state capitals. And so we think we benefited from that. I just want to thank Senator Posansky for all of his diligence in attending, I think, every one of our work groups, and Lou Savage from DCBS, who coordinated the staffing and all the drafts that we went through on this. You have a list of work group members. At least there's a handout over here. One name missing from that, I think, is Eva Novick from Department of Justice, and Eva was a very regular participant in all of our work and brought that perspective from the Department of Justice to it. Just one comment that this is not really an issue where that pits business interests against consumer interests. We really are all on the same side on this. This is businesses and consumers fighting bad people who would like to steal from our consumers. And to the extent that people do that, it diminishes public confidence in our ability as retailers or as, people trying to find customers. It erodes that if we don't protect people's information. So it really is, I'd say everybody on that list is really on the same side, trying to bring you a good bill and to fight off those who would attempt to steal people's identity. So those are really my comments, Mr. Chair, and just appreciate everybody who worked to bring you this bill, and I think it's a good piece of work.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of TransUnion, the Oregon Collectors Association, and the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. I, too, was a member of this work group. Senator Brzezinski was an active participant, and we thank him for that. DCBS was instrumental in helping us facilitate this work group. I would just say a couple of things. It is very important, I believe, that the one of the most important decisions, I believe, that we made in this work group early on was that with respect to safeguarding information, the provisions in this bill would apply equally to the private and public sectors. And as you look across the nation, about half of the security breaches have been in each sector. So that is why the regulation wound up in the Department of Consumer Business Services, because Oregon's Fair Debt Unfair Trade Practices Act would not apply to the public sector, and would, we believe, would put the Attorney General in a conflict of interest. So it's important that it remain there, however it is funded, and we did have a lot of discussions about the funding, and at this point I have one client who's participating in the funding, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. And I think there are some concerns from part of the financial community. My client sort of reluctantly agreed that this was an okay mechanism. We're not, they're not enamored with it, but agreed to go along with it. So if the committee chooses to keep this or to move to a different funding mechanism like the general fund, I think that's a decision you need to make. I think as an ongoing funding source, Corey has told you that she would use the securities money rather than ending balance money from those people that she's using in this biennium, and if that occurs, that's fine. I think there is you'll hear more about that from other folks. I worked primarily on the security freeze portion, allowing consumers to freeze their credit file, and I think TransUnion believes that through the work of this committee, currently we have about 25 states that allow consumers to freeze their credit file, and probably the language in here is the best in the country for consumers and credit reporting agencies. So we think we've struck a really good balance there. So with that, I'll end and be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the freeze, and I realize it's a good idea to have it in the statute, so I'm not against that. But don't many companies that provide credit cards, credit services, and that sort of thing allow internally for customers to freeze their accounts with them, so that if they to protect themselves from identity theft or from credit card theft?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, with respect to the credit file freeze, this is a freeze of your credit report at the credit reporting agencies such as TransUnion and the other two major credit reports. So, and the idea here is that someone can't walk in to a retail establishment using your identity and obtain your the retailer might try to access your credit report and give that individual credit in your name. So to that extent, it only deals with the freezing at that level and would make it mandatory.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony very much. Mr. Fiskum, and then we're going to have Mike Dewey and Aubrey Robinson, but we'll wait until Mr. Fiskum finishes. Bring the two of you up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health System. I'm pleased to support Senate Bill 583, and for reasons of your time, perhaps my own, I'll be as brief as I can. It is important, for the record, for Providence to go on record in favor of Senate Bill 583. By the way, I also do so on behalf of a couple other of my clients who have reviewed the provisions of Senate Bill 583 very carefully, Electronic Data Systems, as well as Pacificare United of Oregon, a health insurer. I was on the interim work work group. I attended many, not all, the meetings. And I would credit Senator Brzezinski as well as DCBS for putting together a collegial group that produced the results you have before you. The reality is, you know, is that Providence incurred a year ago or so a major data theft. At the time, we responded assertively and aggressively, and in fact, one of the outcomes of that is that we worked hard on this legislation and support it. Some labeled us the poster child for ID theft, and our aspiration was to become also the poster child for an aggressive and assertive, workmanlike, businesslike response to theft, and we believe we achieved that. One last quick comment. There has been some confusion in some quarters about whether healthcare enterprises were in fact exempt from the provisions of Senate Bill 583, and they, insurers and healthcare enterprises, are in fact not exempt. The clause in the bill, you'll note, that avoids the duplicative requirements that might exist between federal HIPAA as well as this bill. But at the same time, many of the provisions of Senate Bill 583 actually apply to organizations such as those I represent in the very unfortunate circumstance when there is a theft. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, but it's important for us to go on record of the current version of Senate Bill 583. With consensus amendments, if there are some. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Questions? Thank you. Mr. Dewey and Ms. Robinson. Morning, Mike.
Good morning. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing LexisNexis. Audrey Robinson is with me. She's a lawyer. She resides in Washington, D.C. with LexisNexis, and she travels the country to deal with these issues. We're not here to oppose the bill. We do have some amendments. The Dash 14 are authored by ours. My instructions to LC were not real specific, and we struggled right away to get that amendment fixed, and I'll hand that out to you in just a second. We are, mea culpa here, we are late to the party. We express that to the senator that has chaired the work group in the committee. We thought there would be, quite frankly, another opportunity with a bill like this to have the discussion in a policy committee. And I recognize that there are restrictions that you have with regard to your rules, albeit are not the tightest in the world dealing with land use, as many of you did. There might have been an exception there. So we want to have this, if you will, we know time is short, a discussion about some of the issues, and we'll talk about three amendments, and we'll go through that very quickly. I'm going to hand out the, if you will, the Dash 14, and also for you is some information regarding what has happened in 33 states that have public records exceptions, and we would be unique with regard to that. So we'd like to first of all talk about the Dash 13 amendment, which is the harm amendment, we had offered up some language, as I recollect, to the committee on the Senate side that dealt with financial harm. This is an identity theft bill, and the director of DCBS talked about other types of harm, and the discussion was financial harm, and our amendment deals with identity theft and fraud, which is financial harm. So I'm going to, if I may, Mr. Chair, move this over to Ms. Robinson. She'll talk about 13 and 14 is the redaction, which we think is in the best interest of the consumer with regard to identity theft. It's kind of an inside baseball issue. And then last but not least is the issue of Social Security numbers and the public exception that we have in this bill with the per unit.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Audrey Robinson. I work for Reed Elsevier. LexisNexis is a division of Reed Elsevier, and many of you may be familiar with the legal researching. You can look up case law. Many attorneys do so on LexisNexis. We also collect public records from about 40,000 different data sources. We collect those records, standardize them so that they're searchable across any type of platform, because they come in either paper, mag tape, disk, things of that nature. So we can standardize those and then make them searchable and usable to consumers. The first item that I wanted to discuss, because it was previously addressed by panel members and Senator Przanski, was the harm standard located on page 4, the Dash 13 amendment. This bill clearly states in its title that it's an Identity Theft Protection Act. I submit to you that if you are trying, it's your intent that you're trying to protect against the harm of ID theft, fraud, that the harm standard should say so. Leaving a reasonable harm standard for interpretation by DCBS or by the courts would create an uneven standard for businesses to comply with and an uneven standard for consumers to know what type of harm they may be subjected to if they receive a notice such as this. You know, remember, this is when they should be notified. So if a person is getting a notification in the mail, we want them to take this seriously and say, hey, I need to pay attention. My information could be subject to ID theft or fraud. Some financial harm could come of this. And I think it's important that if the legislature feels that this is an ID theft protection bill, that the harm standard should be specific and define down what that harm is. I think the second amendment that you have is the Dash 14, which is the redaction standard for Social Security numbers. The definition of redacted refers in this bill to the last four digits of a Social Security number. Now, what you're trying to do here is say, what is the least sensitive information for the public to be able to see? We'll show them the last four, according to this bill. Well, I think it's important to know where Social Security numbers, what their genesis is. And the first three numbers of a Social Security number are coded for the state in which it was issued. So Alaska or Montana, which have smaller populations, they've only ever had one set of coding for those first three numbers. So if you live in, say, Alaska, it might be 053 or 056 for all eternity. So thus far, since socials have been issued, everyone has those same three. The following two numbers, the middle two, are coded for the year in which it was issued, and the Social Security Administration Office keeps a table, and it jumps by two, 94, 96, 98, those kind of numbers. And then the last four are coded for you individually. Those are the ones that are specific to identify who you are. So it's the state, a year, and you. So we submit that it's not necessarily the safest practice for consumers to be shown the last four digits. So that's what that amendment addresses, saying if we're showing the public something, let's show them a redacted standard that may not be unique to them. It's unique to your state and the year, but it's common to very many people in the state. And the third amendment that you have, I believe, is dash 11, which is a public records exception issue. 33 states have a fairly standard public records exception. And information found in public records is made available under law without regard to the identity of a user, the intended use. It's made available by government offices, government websites, public and other private channels. All members of the public are entitled to access public records, and it doesn't make sense, really, to treat lawful public access to a public document as a security breach. So if a social security number happens to be in a public record, if we know it's there, we redact it. In some cases, as many record custodians can tell you, they're in unusual places. They may be masked. There could be a letter after it where a computer algorithm wouldn't necessarily pick up the fact that it was a social security number. And so, in effect, because of the unusual public records exception that you would have here in Oregon, any public record that was accessed would have to be searched upon any type of... if you're looking to find if there were a breach, you would have to look through every single public record to make sure that one wasn't hidden. And again, this is a very unique standard, unique to Oregon, that would be included in this. So those are kind of the three amendments. I would entertain any questions that you may have on those, but we think that it makes good policy sense and for both consumers and for business, and we would appreciate your consideration.
So if I understand it correctly, and I have some questions, we're looking at the dash 11, 13, and 14 as your amendments.
That is
12 somehow or another went by the wayside.
Correct, due to a drafting error.
Okay. It wasn't a drafting error. It was
my
error in instructions. I want to make that
I didn't
clear.
Know you made those.
And before I do that, I do understand, if you will, the bugaboo about social security numbers coming to this issue. It's very interesting to, when you talk about social security numbers, people kind of freeze up. And they don't want to have that conversation because they're concerned about what's in the public domain. But with regard to social security numbers, like it or not, when this data is useful for law enforcement, it's useful for background checks for employment. And it's that, if you will, kind of the last identifier as you try and make sure that Chris Edwards, Representative Edwards, told me that there's somebody by his name in Texas that has an unsavory past, and that's a common name, so it's important as we talk about credit, law enforcement, whatever the case may be, that we can make sure Chris Edwards or Mike Dewey is the person who is applying for the job, isn't the person that was convicted of a crime. So I want to make that clear, notwithstanding the fact that we don't like talking about Social Security numbers. If we use them the right way, they are very useful in our society.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I want to stick on the subject of Social Security numbers. What I thought I just heard Ms. Robinson make the case for is that if a Social Security number is out on a document, it ought to be fair game.
No, ma'am. If there is a Social Security number in a public records document, we do try and redact those, and I believe the state of Oregon is trying to do so as well. I know there was recently a Secretary of State bill to redact certain informations. Again, in some circumstances, they're kind of hidden in documents that in places where you wouldn't normally expect them. And I think that this just makes clear that in those instances, it's in the public domain already. You can go down to a clerk's office and pick up that document, and the person would not be notified of a breach. Yet if it were seen online, they would be notified. And I just think that that sets up a standard where perhaps a consumer feels a false sense of security that their socials are they're being notified in these cases but not in others.
I have a quick question.
You better hurry because we've been called.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. I happen to sit in a committee that heard the Secretary of State's bill, and if I remember testimony correctly, you did oppose that bill, too.
Yes, we did.
Are we going to have a chance to ask questions?
Well, if we get back in time.
Okay. For the benefit of the audience who may not understand what's happening here, the House is under a call of the House, which makes their attendance mandatory, and the House members are leaving. And so, with the okie-dokie of the chair, I think we'll just continue to work through the witness list and reserve questions.
We'll rely on you for all the answers.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Robinson, could you suggest some examples of the unintended consequences of the current use of harm in this bill?
Well, I would just say that they're having a vague harm standard would require potentially an over-notification of consumers on businesses' part because they feel, well, if we could be subject to fines and penalties because we did not notify of a potential harm, whatever it may be, if it'll cause a loss of sleep of an hour for this person, you know, is that a reasonable enough harm that we have to notify? Well, I think most reputable businesses would want to err on the side of caution and notify in that case, and so then you're getting essentially what many consumers would probably think to be junk mail because you're getting many notices saying, well, we're not sure, but it could be, so we're going to send it to reduce our liability and to make sure that your harm could be covered. So I think that vague standard could potentially lead down the road to an over-notification of consumers, which would, I think, take away from the importance of vigilantly guarding your credit.
Follow-up, Senator Whitson.
And Mr. Robinson, you're primarily concerned, if I understand, about non-economic damages here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair and Senator, it might be, depending on the mood of the committee, there could be a rule on harm, potentially. We just think it's important to have the standard be a little bit more objective, if you will.
Okay. Thank you. Call forward now Mr. Martinez and Laura Osberg. Morning.
Morning. Morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. And just a couple of notes on the work group process and the result, and then a few thoughts on the amendments. A little bit of background. According to the Federal Trade Commission, Oregon ranks about 13th in the nation for the incidence of identity theft. Victims of identity theft spend hours and hours and a lot of money working to restore their good names. Most people have had it happen to them or someone they know, and it's a problem that we're very interested in putting a stop to. Two of the significant factors contributing to the incidence of identity theft are how easily thieves get their hands on personal information, and how easy it is for those thieves to use that information to open up new fraudulent credit accounts. And what this bill does is represents solutions in both of those areas, both in reducing the availability of information to identity thieves, and also helps to make that information, even if they do get it, less helpful to the identity thief by through the security freeze. So both of those elements of the bill are very helpful to consumers. A couple of pieces on the proposed amendments that I wanted to note. The The redaction issue, how much of the Social Security number you show or not, is actually one that was discussed a little bit amongst members of the work group about which pieces should be shown. And it's true that each of the elements of the Social Security number are not unique to each person. Other people might have those first two numbers, those first three numbers, those middle two numbers, or the last four numbers. And the important thing is in practice now, I think we're all very used to those last four numbers being the ones that are not redacted, the ones that are visible. One of the concerns with having instead other portions of the Social Security number be acceptable to be visible is that an identity thief can put two and two together and put some unredacted Social Security numbers in one place for an individual together with unredacted portions of Social Security number for an individual from another place, and very easily get the most powerful bit of information, which is, of course, the entire Social Security number for that individual, which really is the key to that person's financial and even more than just their financial identity. Social Security numbers and credit reports are used in more than just finances, used for people who are looking to get employment, looking for an apartment, looking for a number of different pieces. So that's an important piece. We wrestled with that, and I think what you see before you in the existing bill is something that we feel most confident about. But overall, use of Social Security numbers, I think, is troubling generally, and the reduction of their use and display is overall a good idea. On the section, sort of the exemption, when you don't have to notify. So page 4, lines 10 through 15, it's section 3, subsection 7, the harm standard. This is one that we also discussed in the work group. This is actually not in all identity theft bills across the country, not all security breach bills. California, for example, does not include any such exemption. And if you are a business or government that has breached the private security information of an individual, you notify them. You don't evaluate yourself whether or not you think it will cause harm or will cause identity theft or will be misused. You simply notify them. You lost their information. Your security wasn't strong enough to keep their information out of the wrong hands, you notify them. In this bill, there is a step back from that level of protection, and it does allow for the entity that experienced the breach to not notify in certain cases. This is actually an area that we have some concerns about and we'll be watching closely, but still believe that on the balance, the whole bill is a step forward for Oregon consumers. And finally, in the area of the public records, Social Security, I think that most consumers are aware that Social Security numbers are in some public documents, but feel better about them being in paper documents somewhere in the files as opposed to on the Internet or combined in databases that are being sold and traded across the country and across the world. We want to make sure we're being as protective of this personal information as possible and think this is entirely appropriate in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. Martinez.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm extremely disappointed that the members of the House are not here. I think this is the first time since I came to the lobby profession in 1991 where I've had the pleasure to testify with Osberg. So I'm sorry that the House is not here for
that. That's noted for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Oregon Bankers Association is very supportive of Senate Bill 583. We were part of the work group. We've worked closely with Senator Przanski, and we thank him for his leadership on this effort, as well as DCBS, and thank them for not only their involvement, but they actually put together most of the work group meetings and really helped us get through this process. At the end of the day, I really think we have a good bill that we can all support. And again, the House isn't here, but I would just add that as the House looks at Senate Bill 965, which is a subprime lending bill that's currently floating around somewhere out there, I would encourage them to look at this model and not do something in haste in the 2007 session's waning days. As has been mentioned before by most of the folks up here, this is a good bill. It is going to be located in DCBS. We're very pleased that that's where it's going to be. There were other agencies and parts of government that have liked to have had it in their area, but I think for all of us, DCBS makes the most sense. And again, thank them for allowing that to be placed in Corey's area. That does raise, as you've heard, a couple of questions from us. One is the National Bank preemption. As you've heard, there has been a case recently out of the Supreme Court, the Wachovia case, which makes it very clear, I think, some disappointment to some of the states that the OCC is the primary regulator and in many cases the only regulator for national banks. I appreciate Ms. Streisinger's comments on that for the record. We're obviously supportive of that. We had an amendment drafted to make that even more clear. We call that in the banking industry our belts and suspender type amendment, but we are very comfortable with Ms. Streisinger's comments and has seen no need to offer that amendment. The second piece is the funding piece. As was mentioned, we have been involved with that. The United Financial Lobby has been part of that again since day one. I think it's fair to say that the Bankers Association anyway has expressed concern about that funding. After all, these are bankers. They take very serious your money, and we do have a concern about whether it is appropriate to fund it using fees. We appreciate, again, Ms. Streisinger's comments about as she looks forward into the 2009 biennium. She's written us memos to all the folks that are participating in the funding this time to make it very clear it would not be her intent to go that road in 2009. I guess our concern is 2009 is a long ways away. There'll be a lot of changes between now and then. So we're very close to being comfortable with what they're proposing, but we also think it's certainly a decision that this subcommittee and the entire legislature ought to make and ought to look at whether general fund is more appropriate today. Certainly, it's not a lot of money. It's only a little over $200,000. You have the breakdown of how that is going to be raised. Obviously, $30,000 from banking fees is not exorbitant, and we certainly agree with the dollar amount they're looking at, but just believe there ought to be a discussion in this subcommittee on the appropriate way to fund it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Whitson?
Yeah, thank you. Tim, do you have any problem with the current definition of harm in the bill where it could extend to non-economic damages?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, again, we are very comfortable with the bill in total. Will, I think Senator Pozanski even suggest we might be back next session to look at it. I know Laura just did, but we're comfortable with where the bill is right now. We would not suggest any major policy changes to the legislation.
Okay. Thank you very much. We collected the sign-up sheet. I don't know if anyone else has felt the spirit of testimony moving over them. If so, I would invite them to come forward. Okay. There being none, I think in the absence of the House, what we might do is recess this hearing and begin on the other. I'm looking really for advice from LFO. I know we have people here prepared to testify on the other bill. Okay, let's try it this way. We're just now having a consultation about rescheduling House Bill 2648 for Wednesday, and I don't know if there is anyone here who has come at great distance who would like to create a record on that bill, absent the House. Is that the case for anyone who's here? Okay, then I think that's probably the direction that we're going to head. To reschedule 2648 for Wednesday. And I know that there were questions of on the part of the House because they expressed those on the way out. So I don't want to close the opportunity for questions. The Senate is due on the floor in 5 minutes, and we've got guidance, and the House is back. Good.
Part of the House is back.
Part of the House is back.
Magnificent.
Mr. Chair, in your absence, and given the shortness of time and the fact that there were questions with respect to this bill, with the guidance of LFO, they recommended moving House Bill 2648 to Wednesday so that we could conclude on this bill, given that there were questions from the House.
Mr. Walker is comfortable in doing that. That's fine. Let's proceed with the further testimony. Who do we have left?
We made it through all of the signed up testimony. I invited any other testimony from folks who were not signed up, and I think that we had left off with questions from House members as the House was departing to go to the floor.
And Representative Galizio had some questions he wanted to ask.
Right, I was hoping to ask Ms. Robinson, and I'm sorry if maybe these were covered when I was, you know.
Right.
One was on the harm. So you had said that the bill is an identity theft bill, and it's problematic to use the harm standard because it would be open to interpretation, and it provides for an uneven standard for consumers and businesses. So I don't think consumers would be too concerned if there was some kind of harm that had taken place. They would be glad that we passed a bill that prevented that. So, but from LexisNexis perspective or the business perspective, why is the uneven standard, why is that problematic?
Yes, Representative. Audrey Robinson from Reed Elsevier again. To speak to why this could be harmful to have an uneven standard for consumers, just to address that point, one issue would be an over-notification of consumers for non-economic harm. If a business thought that the harm standard was going to be treated in a very open-ended, vague sense, it may behoove a business to notify in any case. And in that case, a consumer would receive notifications fairly regularly, likely, from businesses who or government agencies. And in that case, it may seem to the consumer that it's junk mail. You know, if you receive a number of contractual terms from your credit card companies, many times you throw those away without looking at them. And so our point on the consumer end of this would be that if you receive one of these in the mail, you say, this has a serious risk to me of a harm such as ID theft or fraud that I need to guard against. I need to have my credit monitored. I need to get credit insurance, whatever the case may be. We want this to be something that they sit up and take notice of, not throw in the garbage can. And I was just going to say on the business end, then it also creates a standard where we have to say to ourselves we could be held liable or if there's any type of harm. So we're going to just notify in cases where there may be no actual harm that could befall this person. The tapes were likely destroyed, but we can't verify that last known person had it on the way to the garbage dump or something like that. So it creates a standard where businesses are spending more money to pay for notification and consumers are taking less notice.
Follow.
First comment, then another question. I mean, I would think it would be in a business's interest to not want to alarm consumers, so I think they would think very carefully before sending out a notice. In terms of legal standards, is there a clear legal standard or difference between the term identity theft and the term theft? Do those have absolutely crystal clear distinctions in language so that a judge, in interpreting the term theft, would know exactly what that meant? And interpreting identity theft would know exactly what that meant.
Well, identity theft is defined in this bill. There's a reference to a definition which is already set forth in Oregon law. To be honest, I'm not an Oregon law expert, so I don't know how different that is from a regular theft standard. But I would say that the language that we have offered includes any type of fraud, which would be credit card fraud or any type of theft that would likely occur through ID theft or obtaining information that they shouldn't have.
So there tend to be different standards for these terms.
I don't know that to be the case. I don't have the definitional standards. We're trying to say financial harm. ID theft and fraud was clear by the title of the bill that we thought that was a clear standard. So that's where it came from. We're just trying to narrow it down to something that's more tangible and objective rather than a subjective standard that is open to interpretation.
One more?
Sure.
This is on a different, this is on the public records part?
Sure.
So your business model, you make money selling information, and information often that's hard to come by. Is that correct?
I think in some cases that is true.
Follow-up? So some of these documents that might have Social Security numbers that are quote-unquote hidden, that could be valuable information to some of your clients. So it's for your business model, it's useful to have access to that information because it's in the marketplace, it's valuable. So that's why this would be a problem. Is that right?
No, I don't think so. I think when I say hidden, I'll give an example of it. And in Ohio, their voter registrations, they used to use Social Security numbers as their voter registration number. The legislature there said there must be a change. You have to use some other formulation. Well, essentially, they added an extra digit or a letter to the Social Security number. So when a computer algorithm, when we go through to remove those for public display, it doesn't pick it up because it has a letter, and so it appears as a 10-digit alphanumeric code, not the 9-digit that you're used to seeing. So it would be in a location where you wouldn't expect or a place that you wouldn't expect to see it because the legislature said take them out. It's nothing that we had relied on for use, but it was there. So when I say hidden, that's what I mean. It's not that we use those numbers, but to have to go through the multiple millions of public records we may hold to determine if there is one, that is where the problem lies.
Thank you very much.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me any idea of across the country how many states have 4-digit that they're allowing to be shown versus 5?
As a redaction standard in a breach law or in public records in general?
Public records in general.
You know, we've actually commissioned someone to look into that because we are interested to find out ourselves because in many jurisdictions those are administrative or done through court rules. Sometimes they're in their public record laws. So it's kind of a hodgepodge to try and find where the redaction is occurring. And that's all that I can really say about it, is that, you know, we're trying to find out because it's kind of an uneven, in different states it's in different places in their law. So it's really hard to say with any certainty.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, and Representative Byer, not to your question, but it did trigger the previous testimony with regard to the 4 digits, and I told you involved in the work group, notwithstanding we disagree in terms of how the last 4 could be used to identify somebody, where you have a number of, if you will, four-digit numbers available, and you can locate, you know, this is, they're all over the country. If you have a breach, it's not just going to be Oregon. It could be all 50 states. And so you get information that's, this person lives such and such, this person lives here. So by virtue of the four, you've got a situation where it's easier to identify, to get closer to their Social Security number. It's not as easy with our language on the five. So I wanted to say we disagree, we could have that discussion, but that's our view. Thank you.
Representative Cromwell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up just a little bit on along the lines of Representative Galizio's questioning on the dash 13 amendments. Those are good amendments, right? Didn't you say 11, 13, and 14 were the ones?
Yes.
Okay. I've sort of done a little hand in grossing here, and so would you help me understand the difference in the language? Because when I read lines 10 through 15 with the current language, and then I read the lines 10 through 15 on page 4, by the way, with the language that you're suggesting in the dash 13s, I'm having a real hard time understanding the difference, because to me it's stating the same thing, it's just stating it in a different way. And so the legal mind types need to help me understand this, because I'm not a lawyer.
Well, in the current engrossed version, the 583A, it simply says no reasonable likelihood of harm. The amendment that we have addresses so that there is no harm to the consumers whose personal information has been acquired, has resulted, or will result in identity theft or fraud.
But you've taken the word harm out. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Correct.
But we added.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's added. It says harm to the consumers. So it's qualifying the type of harm.
If I may, Mr. Chair, President Crumble, it's merely the trigger. Rather than the word harm, harm to the consumer that would result in fraud or identity theft. We're trying to be more specific. The word harm is still in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not the way I'm reading the amendment, it's not. I'm reading the amendment is it would say, notwithstanding subsection
one
of this section,
right.
So on and so forth, reasonable for law enforcement, the person determines that there is no reasonable likelihood that identity theft or fraud has resulted or will result from the breach.
Correct.
The current language says, after consultation with relevant statement for law enforcement, the person determines that no reasonable likelihood of harm to the consumers whose personal information has been acquired has resulted or will result in that breach.
I'm sorry, you are correct, sir.
Yeah, I was reading. I
so it's replacing ID theft.
So
it's replacing the word harm with ID theft or fraud.
So what you're trying to do is narrow it down so that it is only identity theft and fraud that this is going to affect.
And as I understand
and
it, that was
any,
the
and,
intent.
And taking the word harm out because it's so broad.
Correct.
All right. Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
So going back to page 2, and I think this is on line 40, by taking out other than a Social Security number, doesn't that broaden it out?
What that does is say that if it is a public record, it's not subject to breach notification, which is the standard of 33 states.
I had a tough time with that also, but it is already in the public domain. Therefore, it's available to everybody. So why have this exemption that only applies?
Okay.
And then one last question, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that the that on the Social Security number, what you're asserting is that by allowing any five digits of the Social Security number in the dash 14s, as opposed to the last four as is in the bill, that what you're asserting is that that will make it more difficult because on computer algorithms it's not going to be as recognizable. Is that correct?
My testimony to that point was that the we redact leaving the last or the first five digits because those are the least sensitive numbers for the public to see. And so our point is that that language would enable us to continue that practice, which is safer for consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm done beating the horse.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you've been more than fair. We appreciate the time here today.
And I see Mr. Senator Pravinsky with his nose in a legal book there. Do you want to give us a quick sort of thing? Because I'm just about to say we're adjourned.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I am. All I'll do is give you the citations.
Please.
Theft is described under the property offenses, ORS 164.015, much broader than the definition that you have for identity theft, which is 165.800. And I would submit to you that when you look at the definition for identity theft, even though it's very good at what it defines, it does not include, as we've put on the record, the term theft. That could be just outright stealing from an individual without deception, just actually stealing. So that is one of the reasons. The other 2 points I want to make based on what I've heard is what Representative Galizio said. LexisNexis is in the business of selling people's personal information about the individuals, and they want to maintain the status quo of making sure that they can continue to sell Social Security numbers, which is the number one primer for an individual's identity to be stolen and access to their credit reports can be obtained. The definition that we currently have in the A and Gross for harm is language that came from LexisNexis. I put it in there at their request, and now they're here complaining about what they asked for. The last part would be the last four digits of the Social Security number. I hope that came through Ms. Etherton's testimony, which you probably didn't hear. It's uniform throughout businesses in the country for the most part. Those are what is actually being maintained in the business sense. We believe, even though it may be better to go to the five digits, we could be setting a new standard that has not been documented, at least from what LexisNexis has said, that is being a prevailing means of doing business in the country. And do we want to set a standard that this work group has already looked at, and we think that we're staying in line with on the national level? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. Question, I appreciate everyone's participation and patience with us this morning. And we will be coming back to this are we close Thursday? On Thursday this week, I think. And Mr. Robinson, thank you for venturing out from Washington, D.C. I hope you had a pleasant trip here and another pleasant trip on the way home. And thank you very much. We are adjourned.